Hello, and welcome to the Locust Roundtable podcast. Today, while I cannot personally be at Worldcon, we have Worldcon coming to us anyway, courtesy of Gary K. Wolf's Mac Air. Say hi, Gary.
Hello, and hello from my Mac Air.
And also, we're joined live from Reno with Eileen Gunn and Kathy Goonan. Eileen, could you say hi?
Hi, I'm Eileen.
And Kathy.
Hi, I'm Kathy.
So, how's you guys' Worldcon going so far?
It's hectic. It's Thursday. We're all vaguely energized, but we have no focus at the moment. Friday, we will develop focus. Saturday, we will really know what we're doing. And by Sunday, we'll be totally spent little vegetables.
Well, that's true. My sense is that this is at once the most appropriate and the most inappropriate venue for a Worldcon. I mean, we're basically, the Worldcon is basically in a casino or in a in a huge, gigantic, rambling convention center, which is attached to a casino. And by and large, my sense is that science fiction fans, if they gamble at all, are actually using the penny slots, which haven't been used by anybody under the age of 80 for the last 7 months. And yet, and there's all this stuff. Tim Powers is a guest of honor who had written Last Call, which is about casinos. And you can't walk through the casino without thinking of Harlan's Pretty Maggie Money Eyes. And yet, it seems inappropriate because the people who occupy the casino are not the same kind of people who attend Worldcon. And there's do you guys get that sense? A real disjuncture?
I got that sense. It's very alien to me anyway. It's like going into a version of my own personal hell. They have these buzzing machines and lights and mirrors, because I have a feeling that the casino area is actually very small, but they make it confusing on purpose. Eileen is very well oriented, so I need a compass. I need a map and a compass to find my way through that.
You follow the walls. It's like you're like rats. Okay, think of it this way: you're like rats in a giant room full of nothing you want to eat. And the way you find what you want to eat is you follow very closely to the wall, because if you go into the middle, you'll get trapped.
Right, exactly.
So you go around the edge of the wall, and eventually you will find something to nibble on or throw up in the air or sit in a panel or whatever.
You might even find an elevator if you're lucky.
Well, and the elevators here are Jules Verne elevators. They're wonderful. They have glowing neon signs. They're exterior to the building. So you're really going up in these capsules that are very science fictional and completely anti-science fictional at the same time, because they are so 60s Hyatt in a way. But by and large, the sessions I've been to have been well attended. The people seem to be nice. I generally don't like world cons because it's so hard to get together with people. I'm glad, Karen, I'm glad you made us do this, because otherwise the three of us would be down in an overcrowded party thinking we have to be having fun because this is the only place to have fun right now.
Well, and thank Eileen and Kathy, because they both independently came up with the idea.
Oh, good. Excellent.
So talk about synergy.
Yes, exactly.
And, well, here's one of the things I'll start asking Kathy this, because This Shared Dream is her new novel, which is, I think, in part a utopian novel and in part a dystopian novel. And
wait, can you be both?
Can you be both? Well, that's a good question. Can you be both?
Well, apparently, because I have both. You know, I think to have either one is very unbalanced. So I don't think you can have one without the other. And so, you know, one has to mirror and echo the other. And the utopian part of it is like a shared dream, in that, you know, what we're moving away from is the dystopia of war and violence that seems to be embedded in humanity. So this is my science fictional solution. So in that sense, you know, it is a very utopian novel with the darker underpinnings of World War II.
Well, yeah, and we should mention that this is a sequel to In War Times, which is
which has to do with manipulating the future. The reason I said it was both at once is that I see something which is becoming, I'm seeing it not only in your novel, but a much more widespread, that dystopia is not something horrible that's going to happen in the future. It's pretty much the world we've already built for ourselves.
Yes.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. You mentioned that with the Slow Apocalypse that came out this year as well.
I think that's a new trend. There's this novel by Will McIntyre that Nightshade published called Slow Apocalypse, which basically is built around the premise that you take the recession of the last couple of years and just stretch it out. You don't need nuclear wars. You don't need meteor strikes. You don't need inundation. You don't need worldwide plagues. Like, we can pretty much screw up the world without the aid of any outside agency at all. And the thing that struck me about The Shared Dream is that the dystopian world, which becomes a nightmare from the point of view of the characters, is us. And that's interesting, because the default position, it seems to me, in science fiction has always been vaguely utopian in the past. And I'm not sure it is anymore.
It's just getting by, I think. It's Kathy's book is a way of looking at not really creating a utopia, but getting out of the sort of stagnant dystopia that we're in. It's a way of looking at kind of a 90-degree twist to what we're doing, not 180 degrees, and ending up somewhere better, but it's still not a utopia. Would that be right?
That sounds pretty much correct. And I often think that science fiction is sometimes of course it's unrealistic, and it should be in some ways, but my fiction tends to be more reality based, I think, than a lot of science fictions, and yet the mechanisms by which these better places for humanity are to be reached are based on what we're learning about the brain and neuroplasticity and how we can better learn to deal with our environment now that we have science, and now that we know so much more about how we work and how the world works, maybe we can use that information to actually change things for the better.
We were talking earlier today with David Hartwell about neuroplasticity, and we came up with a different definition.
That's what I was thinking, and I was trying, that's why I paused. I'm thinking, what was that good term?
Well, let's offer a definition of neuroplasticity, because I've seen the word used, and it seems to have a range everywhere from professional neuroscientists to New Age gurus. And I'm not sure what it, I mean, it's like neuro-linguistic programming, which sounds great until you find out that it's a little woo-woo.
It's just, that's actually more like hypnotism.
Well, yeah, right, exactly.
So, neuroplasticity is the ability that when your brain is young, say when you're between the ages of zero and even younger than that, your brain is being built, and it's being constantly wired and rewired according to your inputs. That's why phenomena such as synesthesia interests me, because it's a different way of wiring the brain. This is what happens.
Cross wiring, yes, kind of connection
developmentally. Yeah. So, I'm anticipating. There are a lot of books out now about how you can reprogram your brain even when you're an adult, and say after strokes and things like that. And with functional MRI now, we can see in real time what's happening in the brain as you do certain tasks. And that fascinates me too. So the opportunity to perhaps reattain that neuroplasticity that gives young children the ability to learn languages and learn everything they learn at that age, everything that we learned at that age, but we don't really remember how we did it. So that's, to me, that's my take on what neuroplasticity is and what it can possibly do when we have the ability to do that more precisely.
The other thing that comes up in the novel, though, is, well, you're talking about Montessori education quite a bit. Which is, you're smiling now, that's, which is not necessarily based on any elaborate neurological theories, but it's based on a scientific education, an education that somehow emphasizes rationality, which sounds like what most of us used to think of as just education.
Yes, except it's different because what I call it science-based education is because Montessori was a physician, mm-hmm. and she developed, she experimented basically on her early classrooms in Rome and used the materials that worked out, that, right. that helped the children, you know, learn, focus on different tasks. And she discovered amazing things about how children learn, things that still have not actually been put into effect very widely in our educational system now.
How was what she doing was different from Piaget? It was famously the first psychologist to actually observe children rather than assuming they knew how to behave.
Well, it's different in that years ago I discovered that there is kind of a controversy between the Piagetians and the Montessorians. And uh-huh. Montessori has a reputation for being very rigid. And at the same time, it also has a reputation for the kids can do anything they want.
Right.
And that actually depends on the teacher's point of view. But there's directress, they're the directors or the directresses. So your job as a Montessori teacher is to link the children with the specific things in the environment, depending on where they are developmentally. And you see where they are developmentally by mm-hmm. what they choose to do. So there's a lot of choice involved, and that, you know, that can go in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that fascinates me about both of your novels, but especially the second one, is that it really focuses on the idea of education, which is so seldom the theme of science fiction or fantasy. And it really is what determines the future. And if we're in a dystopia right now of some sort, this is my opinion, and Karen, you can correct me, being younger than all of us here, because people, if education, if American education is going to fail, it already has. Essentially, we have a generation of people who believe in angels and miracles and UFOs and probably not really evolution, and somehow that happened. That's not what's happening with the educational system now. That's what happened to the educational system 20 or 30 years ago.
Wait, back up, because
I was hoping you get a rise out of you with that.
In addition to all the people who believe in angels and creationism and the Earth's only 6,000 years old, you also have these kids who've been, you know, they got the chance to program robots since the time they were freshmen in high school and compete in robotics competitions. I mean, even I didn't have the chance to do that. I mean, the range of options and the range of harnessing kids' creativity through technology has increased immensely over just the last generation.
In some schools.
Absolutely, in some schools. But I'm thinking my nieces went through public school in Colorado, and mm-hmm. My oldest niece, who's now at Occidental, she was... you know, programming robots in machine code to you know, lift balls through hoops and things like that. I was like, I was just amazed at the sophistication of some of the things she was doing.
I think this is an example of the Gibsonian dictum that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the millennialism is still here. And there's pockets of it, and it feeds into the sort of religious euphoria that dominates in some states, and is in some religious, some supposedly secular school systems. But it's not everywhere. And is it that much different than it was 40 or 50 or 60 years ago? I went to a Catholic school,
mm-hmm.
and... I guess we didn't have a lot of Catholicism drummed into us, but we studied the history of the Catholic Church, and we had mm-hmm. theology classes every week, maybe more than once. Maybe we had them every day, but we all kind of got out of that and adjusted well and learned to be scientists and science fiction writers.
I think that it's a failure of it's different cultures. We have so many more pocket cultures, I think, in the United States now, and it's like you choose your own channel. It's like I subscribe to certain parts of the Washington Post, so mm-hmm. I really never see the other ones. I've tuned into my own channel, so I mm-hmm. don't have that serendipity. And I think more and more people want the opportunity to closely micromanage and control every aspect of what their children are doing and learning. And that's why they want to pull away from the culture that they see in American public school. It's like a threat in a way, I think, to a lot of people.
A threat meaning?
To their philosophy. They don't want their children. They want to control the philosophical and religious attitudes of their children in a way that they can't control if they send them to public school. So I think that's a part of it. It's not all, it's not all like, well, the public school is bad and what we're doing is good. I think it's a little bit more culturally oriented than that.
But what I see happening is the public schools are being starved of money.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's not being done by the people that believe in this public schools. It's being done by people who believe that the schools are not in their best interest.
Yes, they want to dismantle the public school system.
Yeah, and this is not being done for the benefit of the pupils. It's being done, perhaps as you said, by the people who are afraid of what is being taught to their own children. And they don't actually care what's happening to all the other children.
No, they don't.
No, I think that I know people who are homeschooling their kids. Well, I don't know these people. I know of them. Actually, they're relatives of mine who pull the kids out of public school because they want to give them a fundamentalist Christian education. There are other people who are homeschooling kids because they're afraid that what the schools are giving them is already too much of a fundamentalist Christian education.
Right.
And as a result, you've got a midstream of public education, which is neither one thing or the other. People are still terrified to teach evolution in schools. And you run through the debate, and we've all had this debate where somebody will say to you, well, education is only a theory, and then you try to explain what a theory is, and pretty soon you're back to base. And these are not kids I'm talking to, these are their parents. And I'm thinking, where do you start? I mean, the kids are growing up in a household, in some cases, not all, that celebrates ignorance. And ignorance is a saleable commodity on the Fox Network. Can I say that on the Locus podcast?
I'll think about it.
Okay.
You lose all your money from
exactly
Fox.
Right.
Oh, yes, all those advertising dollars we were getting from the Fox Network.
I taught, I'm teaching at Georgia Tech now, and I taught a class in science, ideology, and technology that some of the students have to take at Georgia Tech. And most of the students were upper-level students. And I had this idea that I could teach the history of science through biography, because I love biography. Mm-hmm. So my first biography was a Darwin biography, mm-hmm. and Desmond and Moore's biography, a very fat book. Mm-hmm. And I found that, this is in Georgia, this is in a county where if there is something controversial in a textbook, they put a sticker on the cover that says, warning, evolutionary material inside.
Oh.
So some of the students were absolutely delighted to be in a course like this. Some of the students were, a few of the students were threatened, and they took a more religious approach. They said things like, Darwin was, the Bible frowns on first cousin marriages, and that is why Darwin's daughter died, to punish Darwin and things like that. So there were, all kinds of attitudes, but that was kind of what the class was about. And I had them read, I said, okay, I want all of you to go online, it's free, get The Voyage of the Beagle, and just choose a chapter at random. And they were able to see how rational and how this process mm-hmm. unfolded, for Darwin, and how the confluence of all his different influences suddenly were able to crystallize in this vision of what might be going on, his theory. And there were many theories at that time, and there's still, it's an evolving theory. So, yes.
Well, it's still a theory. Okay, Karen, correct me on this. It's still a theory in the sense of the most efficient way to account for the available evidence. People tend to read theory as an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we run up against again and again. Well, it's just a theory.
Right. Under that definition, you say gravity is just a theory.
Exactly. That's where I was going. So how do you counter that? I don't know.
Well, of course, the other problem is that I'm just thinking, you're talking about all the theories that are floating around back in the 19th century. Intuitively, you can see some people still actually act as if they believe Lamarckian evolution was true.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such an intuitively attractive idea. So some of these things just never die.
And the Lamarckian theory was still actively promulgated in the Soviet Union in the 20s and the 30s. It's not like it was that far away from contemporary theory. People can kind of make themselves believe whatever it is they want to believe.
Well, and you can make it work logically. One of the ironic things about Ted Chiang's fiction is that he makes completely irrational theories work rationally because I wonder if Ted, I've had this conversation with Ted, and maybe some of you had, but on the one hand, you're absolutely doing wonders with alchemy and golems and your own, but on the other hand, aren't you showing that these completely discredited cosmologies work just as well as our own?
He's good at that.
He's very good at it. Because his understanding is that the methodology, the rational methodology of science, works in various different kinds of systems. And given a different set of coordinates, a different set of givens, you can still make science work. And I don't think Ted Chiang is being read by, well, people who watch Fox Network very much. But by and large, that's part of the problem, is that the confusion between the initial assumptions and the methodology used to address those assumptions. So that if you believe that, if your assumption is that God planted the fossils there to fool us, nothing, you can segue that into a perfectly logical explanation of everything.
And you can pass all your exams.
And you can pass all your exams too, yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that I like Kathy's idea of sending them back to the original origin of species, because it gets them focused on the thought processes, sort of the Changian part of the process, where you're looking at how a scientist works and how he thinks about things and how he works it out. And I think that is helpful to the students, whatever their religious beliefs are. I grew up in an observant Catholic household. We weren't weird. We believed in science. We understood certain aspects of physics. We didn't discount evolution or any of that. But belief is a separate system from science. And the students need to be able to identify these as being two different ways of looking at the world and learn both of them if they want to be believers.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean they shouldn't actually study science and understand how science works, because it doesn't obviate their belief.
It's a very useful tool. Yes.
Well, you get to interesting scientist priests like Teilhard de Chardin, where you're trying to figure out a way to make both of these worldviews work.
Right.
And it's kind of cool, because actually there have been science fiction and fantasy novels based on the Omega. Like, is, I think, exactly what you're saying. So it's at some point these worldviews can be made to converge. And philosophically, maybe they do converge. But you're dealing with a very intellectual form of religion to get to that point. And Teilhard was constantly in trouble with the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
Although I love the idea of teaching science classes and the history and philosophy of science through biography. I've often thought that, that would make classes a lot more interesting, especially for the non-specialist student, because there are so many fascinating personalities involved in science. They're not all these...
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. I used a biography of Lisa Meitner, who was the physicist who put everything together and, realized that nuclear fission was possible and, wrote out the equations and stuff. She's a fascinating person. So I used Richard Feynman, James Gleick's biography. Alfred Loomis, who is more technology, he was biography is Tuxedo Park, and he was very much involved in in government and industry, and he was a wealthy person who really liked science. So when he made all his money before the crash, he had soirees at Tuxedo Park, and he invited all the, you know, the physicists in the mm-hmm. world to come there. Niels Bohr, Einstein, you know, that was the place to be and the place to talk and exchange ideas. And he was very influential during the war in getting shortwave radar manufactured and setting up the MIT Rad Lab. So there was, you know, there was a lot for the engineers, and they could see all the different personalities. And I ended up with Eric Kandel's In Search of Memory, because that was really one of the books that started me working on this shared dream. And he's a very, very good writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt as if the books were very readable and they would just unfold because they're written, well written. So it's not like they're reading textbooks of how this happened.
I've heard you talk before about the origins of this shared dream, and it seems to come from a different place than in war times. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's because the book is sequential, and after in war times, it seems that maybe you conceived them both at the same time. But you describe in the shared dream as being a different intellectual process of starting it.
Well, yes, this in war times was based directly on my father's World War II memoirs, stories, basically, that he had been talking about since I was little, you know, and trying to explain to me how radar works and stuff like that I didn't understand when I was 8, 10, or 12. But it started to all make sense to me later on, and I realized how valuable and how interesting they were, because he had 3 years of chemical engineering when he enlisted in the Army, but he was myopic. So he was an ordnance engineer. And he worked at the Aberdeen Proving Ground. He was selected out and he was sent there to study the shortwave radar, which was then just top secret stuff. And then he went to England and worked on ordnance building things and had some really interesting experiences in London. And he has this whole intact memory of the war, what it's like to be living through a time when really you think the world, as we know it, will definitely mm-hmm. end. And, you know, this huge threat of Hitler. And so I did a lot of research on that. And then a lot of people wanted to know more about Betty, the fictional wife of my fictional Sam Dance, who so actually a large part of this shared dream, which is not in there right now, was mm-hmm. Betty's experience in the OSS, and also Haddon's, Eliane Haddon's. Oh. How did she come to be? How did she come to get this education that was not really available to women at that time? And Lisa Meitner, I had read the Lisa Meitner several biographies. There are two main ones that are out right now. And she was kind of my model for how a woman in Vienna at that time could get an education. At the same time, Montessori was too, because mm-hmm. she got the first medical degree that a woman ever got in Italy in 1896. Mm-hmm. And she spoke at this International Women's Congress then in Berlin. And that too, I don't think that's in the book, but it's kind of the background.
The Kristallnacht business is in the book, and I was going to ask, because I did some. I will not do this until after I've written your review, but sometimes I want. Is that right? And I never looked up whether Montessori was involved in Kristallnacht.
Well, actually, yes, she was hung in effigy and burned and stuff like that. Yes,
right.
She was a huge threat to fascism, because before Mussolini took power, there were Montessori schools all throughout Italy, and it was like becoming more of a state kind of method of education. And Mussolini took the idea that, okay, we can make these children like little soldiers. And Montessori said, no, you know, that's not what I'm all about. I'm mm-hmm. making them, I'm trying to help them learn how to think for themselves. And so she became a direct threat to fascists And they all her books were thrown burned, you know, in Germany and yeah.
Is one of the things, and I can ask this of both of you because you've both done this, seems to me one of the most challenging things to do in fiction, not alone in science fiction, is to represent people thinking without having the kind of movie cliche of, you know, sitting smoking one cigarette after another while having, you know, daiquiris and looking out over the bay, the kind of... But, for example, you mentioned biographies. One of the things I really liked about Kim Stanley Robinson's novel Galileo's Dream was not the far future science fiction bit of it, but the fact that he actually was able to explain point by point how using a 16th century primitive telescope, seeing only what you could see then, which means what any 11-year-old kid could do now, how you draw the conclusions about the recession of Jupiter's moons and this sort of thing. And I thought, it's really hard to do that and make it exciting, but I was absolutely turning pages, knowing exactly what was going to come out. Of course he's going to discover Jupiter's moons. Is that a challenge as a writer to represent thought rather than action?
I think probably the challenge for me is to have more action and less thought. So I have to, yeah. That's a challenge for me.
So you're confessing to being intellectual. Oh, come on.
I hear that from people and I think, oh, okay, well, I'll accept that, but I don't feel it at all like that, really. I just like to read, and I do like to think. I like to draw conclusions, and I like to write.
Well, being an intellectual doesn't mean being unemotional, and certainly both in War Times and in The Shared Dream are passionate books. It's just what you're passionate about, I think, that makes a difference.
Oh, I think Kathy's books, all of them, not just these two books, but all of her books, are passionate about knowledge,
mm-hmm.
about... I'm discovering how the universe works and how music works and how people interact in the shared dreams, how families work and function and don't function. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, if that's intellectual activity, well, there you go. Sounds like it to me.
Well, thank you, Eileen.
I think it works. I mean, it's interesting in the mainstream where we have, it seems to me, by the mainstream, I'm using the science fiction usage of the mainstream, which is something that the mainstream itself does not acknowledge at all. Thomas Mann wrote very well about ideas, and I'm not sure anybody reads Thomas Mann novels anymore. I'm thinking about things like Dr. Faustus. I'm totally blanking on that. But
The Magic
Mountain. Sometimes you see that in contemporary general fiction, but more often than not, it's either dealing with the psychological depths and angst of characters, which is fascinating, but the characters are not necessarily very thoughtful, they're just pained, or usually at the opposite extreme, write nothing but action and adventure. You don't ever see James Bond thinking about anything, whereas at least Arthur Conan Doyle wrote fiction about people thinking, and I don't know where I'm going with that at all.
Well, there's just a wide spectrum of readers. So
yeah, I guess so.
That's all. The people read for different reasons. And some people read to be entertained. Some people read to be challenged. Some people read for, you know, the adventure, the intellectual adventure. Uh-huh. Actually, I think a lot of science fiction readers are like that they want to be challenged in that way. I don't think that there's any way that I could have written the novels that I've written non-science fictionally. I think it takes that dimension, and I think that it's not the only way to write that kind of thing, but it's like taking all the possible elements, all the possible colors in a writer's palette, and using them in this way. That's what makes science fiction exciting for me to read and to write.
What makes it exciting for you?
I don't know. I don't know, you know, in science fiction per se, I don't know. But in writing about characters and how they think, which is what I was just musing on, I noticed that my children think a lot. Children are always trying to figure out, my children characters are always trying to figure out things. And most of their ideas are wrong, but they keep working at it. And I wonder if my adults keep working at it. Or if maybe my adults all think that they already know how everything works and they don't think about it very much, which is quite possible. At the moment, I'm working on a story that seems to involve Mark Twain, and it will ultimately involve how Mark Twain thought about things and how he changed his thinking. And I don't know if that's the process of thinking, or it's simply a way of looking at thinking as if it occurred rationally in an orderly fashion, which it doesn't. Your brain works in clumps, and it communicates in ways that you don't know about. And to me, that's what's interesting. And that's what is interesting to me about my adult characters, anyway, is that they're not necessarily putting things together rationally or linearly. Mm-hmm. When they think, it's all going on in the background, and they may be doing something else. They're certainly all thinking. With Holmes, you see Sherlock Holmes think. He lays it all out for you because that's part of the game of the story. And that's the action in a lot of ways of a Sherlock Holmes story. It is action. And it was action. It ought to work as action today. It works as action in detective novels today, I think.
Actually, the new BBC Sherlock Holmes series, I think, does that very well. I'm very fond of it. It's a completely contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes. It looks to me like a kid who's maybe 30 years old playing Sherlock Holmes. But they're running these little superpositions of equations and observations on... And it's a visualization of what Sherlock Holmes is seeing that we aren't. And I think it's utterly fascinating.
It's a great way to portray that kind of thing. And getting back to your children, Computer Friendly was one of the stories that I taught this year and in the short story science fiction class. And the students really could get into that. And you can see the girl in Computer Friendly as she, you know, runs into these problems. You can see her thinking in action because she, you know, decides what to do, how to find the solution to this problem that's suddenly enveloped her and made her world very dangerous. So they really enjoyed that story.
Mm-hmm. And that's good. I like the way that she thinks. In some ways, since I've been rereading Huckleberry Finn, the first half or two-thirds of Huckleberry Finn is about Huck thinking.
It's about Huck thinking, realizing that what his parents have told him about the world isn't the world.
Yeah.
And then beginning to incorporate other experiences. And once he gets to know Jim, he can't accept the world he's been given. And that I think is a that's why I think it's one of the great American novels. That's a universal experience of growing up is testing what your parents told you against what you know to be reality,
and testing the not just his parents but his whole society.
We're right.
What his whole society is telling him, and he feels disobedient for making up his own mind about things, which I think is just great. And that's like the first two thirds of it. I think after that, Twain put the novel aside for a couple of years, and I don't know at which point he put it aside. But the last third or so is all about action. It's all about people jumping around and doing Keystone Cops kind of stuff over and over again in different ways. And I wonder if it's a reaction to the first part. If Twain thought, you know, maybe there's too much thought going on up there, and we'll just mix it up at the end. I don't know. I haven't figured that out. Do you have a theory?
I don't know. It's funny because...
I need to reread Leslie Fiedler.
You need to talk to Jeff Ryman, who was doing a couple of years ago when he spent the winter in Hannibal. Karen, didn't you have but he was looking at the same thing. Like he was trying... I don't think his novel is anywhere close to being done, but he wanted to recreate the experience of being in Hannibal, Missouri over about at least a winter. It was fascinating. And what he was trying to do was to see the world the way Huck would have seen it. And there are still, you know, substrata of that world left in Hannibal under all the neon signs and the tourist traps and that sort of thing. And I don't know what his conclusions were, but he was asking exactly the same question.
You definitely have convergent writing interests.
But Karen,
I think they'll come up with different answers.
Karen, did you have Jeff on a...
I haven't yet. And actually, okay. I'm sort of laughing because my original email to Eileen was, oh, hey, do you think you and Jeff Ryman would like to do a podcast together? Hmm. Unfortunately, Jeff hasn't been available, so...
No, Jeff will... he's not here.
I know. Yeah. I'm hoping we'll run into him at another con someday, and we'll hopefully grab him as well.
Well, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me about what Eileen's saying now and what Jeff has said and what I've heard from any number of other writers is the extent, is because this came up again at ReaderCon where Mark Twain was the dead guest of honor this year. And you begin to realize how much of an influence he had on science fictional writing in the sense of the representation of thought. In other words, Huck Finn lies behind Hugh Hoyland in Heinlein's universe in many ways. Somebody who sees the surroundings as giving him different information from what he's inherited and having to compare those and having to act on it in the end. And as a matter of fact, Heinlein was very fond of Mark Twain. We know that. So the fact that Twain wrote very little fantasy and science fiction doesn't influence the fact that his representation of thinking, which is what we're talking about, was in some ways very science fictional. Huck Finn was one of the first rationalist American heroes whose actions were determined by his thought processes rather than his courageous, fearlessness. He was not Natty Bumppo from Last of the Mohicans. He was somebody who was figuring out the world as he went through it. That's what you do in a science fiction story. Okay, I'm the end of lecture. Can we talk about something else now?
I don't think I'd ever tire of hearing about Mark Twain. Actually.
Although I know I just finished reading Greg Egan's Clockwork Rocket, which is, of course, very, very hard SF. And one of the things I... Just random connection as I was reading it, talking about how to dramatize people thinking. He uses dialogue quite a bit. Yalda is the main character. There's some very good extended passages where she's talking with basically her graduate advisor and trying to convince him of her theories. And it almost seemed to harken back to me all the way back to Galileo's dialogue on Two New Sciences. Mm-hmm. That sometimes that's a way that we've been able to have those kind of make science storyable.
I think one of the things that Greg Egan was doing in that was, in a weird way, similar to what Neal Stephenson was doing in Anathem, which is let's just reinvent science from the ground up. In the case of Stevenson, it was let's do Western philosophy using different names. But following the same logical progression. And what the Clockwork Rocket does is let's change the basic rules of physics and create a new world and then go through the whole history of physics in this new world.
Well, and they both end up with relatively young people being flung into space. So, I mean...
Exactly. So.
What happens in many of his books, but Greg Egan is one of my very favorite writers. And he's like, you can read his books and it starts out with this premise, and okay, you accept the premise, and then he gradually takes you out farther and farther on speculative limbs, and you end up with this grand vision at the end that is just so strange and wild, and you could never, I mean, he really does build a whole structure in worlds with every one of his books.
The problem is getting there, because the problem is, in this case... I don't care if your reaction is the same. In this case, Egan has enormous amounts of stuff on his website explaining to you how variable the speed of light varies according to wavelength, which sounds simple enough until you follow through on what kind of a universe this is. And then, Karen, I don't know if your reaction is my thought in the first couple of chapters, this is as disorienting as any fantasy novel I've ever read. Okay, right. It's really challenging at the beginning, and you realize that everything, unlike a fantasy world, everything in this world is mathematically determined by making a couple of key changes in physics equations. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, one of the only problems I had is because I was reading it with the aim of understanding the science, because I know I'm going to have to explain it on some level later, and I couldn't sort of just skim it. I was trying to pick up everything from the dialogue that he was portraying. I finally got all the way through and to the appendices, and in the appendices, he's willing to just use equations. Yeah. And, you know, myself having a physics background, I was like, oh, is that what you meant? Oh, that's way simpler than I thought it was. You know, because there's a reason that math is so very, very handy.
Not having a physics background, I got to the appendices and was basically thinking polite versions of WTF.
Yeah, I feel like the appendices were really more for me.
But anyway, can you rephrase that as an equation?
It's like all those New Yorker cartoons.
But you're right. He's representing intellectual thought. He's representing the creation of new ideas. The logic, once you understand the universe he's in, the process that his heroine goes through, which is essentially 300 years of physics and astronomy in one career, makes complete sense. And it's in some ways, it's just astonishing to watch that play itself out. And it's a kind of, I think, intellectual thrill that you very seldom can get in a realistic novel. Which is why I mentioned people like Thomas Mann.
And the other thing is that in Clockwork Rocket, unlike, say, Incandescence, in Incandescence you do that 300 years of scientific development in a single generation with an alien society that is basically idealized and free of politics.
Mm-hmm.
In Clockwork Rocket, he puts the real process of science, where you have egos and petty conflicts and you have to argue for funding.
Right. And, the politics of it.
He's gotten so much more sociologically astute, but at the same time, the entry barriers of, you know, his hard SF have gotten higher. And I think it's kind of a shame that he's probably not getting as much attention for some of his social progress that he might have otherwise.
Yeah, and he could write very sensitive economic injustice novels like Terranasia that basically went past most of his readers as not very significant. And
there's room for novels that not everybody gets.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah, right.
but Eileen and Kathy, I mean, you guys both have always been, or have always seemed to be, very aware of how science operates in the real world, in its sort of sociological context. Yeah,
probably Kathy more than me.
Well, I take that as a compliment. It's the result of just starting from scratch. When I started writing, which I was about 35, and I had been a Montessori teacher, and I only did that so that I could support myself while I was learning how to write, because when I was at Virginia Tech, of all places, getting my English degree in the 70s, I realized there was so much that I didn't know about getting published, about making my writing better. I decided that I had to work on it. I had to have control over my life so that I could do that. And the school just kind of mushroomed. It was very popular and successful. So I woke up when I was about 32, I think, and it was just like a voice, you know, it says, if you're going to write, you'd better get started. So I went to Clarion, and Greg Baer said, you know what, all of you need to know something about science. And I thought, okay. And that's when I, you know, started doing a crash course on science, and realizing that the only way for me to access science really without a background in mathematics is in physics, you know, all the basics that you really need to be good at, was to read books written by scientists for lay people, and also, you know, keep up with science news and nature and learn the vocabulary of it, so I at least have a kind of representation of what I think science is about. And at the same time, I realized that I don't really know deeply, you know, what this means, and what the aspects I'll never really understand.
When you get into areas like nanotechnology, you're talking about knowing deeply what that means is something that only a couple of dozen specialists in the world even need to know to make that sort of thing work.
Well, nanotech is something that means one thing when you're talking about it, and another thing if you're a researcher doing it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's very true.
And there's so many, there's different ideas of what nanotechnology is, and I'm kind of 20 years out of date on that, but I was part of the Seattle Nanotechnology Study Group that John Kramer formed in about 1989 or 90. And that was before things started actually happening in it. That was when it was theoretical. And there was a physics type of nanotechnology. There's a chemical type of technology. And we've gone much more with the chemical, the biochemical form of it than the physics aspect of it. But none of what we were talking about, even though, I mean, John is a theoretical physicist, and many of the other people involved in it were either physicists or were engineers in the, you know, building equipment in their basements to study technology with. It was fascinating to be part of that. It's not about what happened, it's about how people were thinking about it at that time and what could happen. And as a science fiction writer, my contribution to the group, I think, from the feedback I got, was that I didn't think about it realistically. I thought about it conceptually and plot development-wise, and how you would use it in a social situation and stuff like that, which I think is the way science fiction kind of works for scientists. It opens their minds to possibilities that the science fiction writer doesn't understand or explain, but that the practical scientist can say, oh, that's not quite right, but you know, if we did this, if we went after that information in that way, and they come up with something very different than what the writer imagined or thought she was going after.
One of the things that fascinates me about the way you approach science thinking is that I'm assuming all of us, with the exception of Karen, we really began as literature people, right? We were like majors in this sort of thing. And it's interesting you mentioned Greg Bear, because Greg Bear is, if I'm not mistaken, somebody who got his degrees in English.
He does. That's why I always like to say, yes, and I have exactly the same background in science as Greg Bear does, a degree in English.
Right. So Greg had to learn science by setting out to learn science to write science fiction. Now, in contrast, boy, am I going to get in trouble with both of these guys. In contrast, Greg Binford had to learn literature because he knew science. He knew physics and cosmology. And it's very interesting to compare their fiction, both of which I admire, but you get a sense that Greg Bear is really striving to get the science right, and Greg Binford is really striving to get the prose right.
Or the people,
the characters, yeah. And they both succeed to a great extent. I mean, I'm not putting it down, but and Karen, as I say, you started with as a scientist, and I know you've been studying science fiction very methodically for a couple of years now.
Oh, yeah. Ever since I met you and Charles at Another World Con just a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
But no, I've learned so much more about literature. But you're right. I made that my own field of study after I was done with my official school STEM education.
Do you, as an engineer, feel frustrated at the likes of us English majors failing to learn the basics of science and engineering to read a story?
Actually, almost never.
Really?
Yeah, honestly. I mean, there've been a couple times where I've read a book and went, oh my god, actually there was one book I remember in particular where the entire plot of the book, the entire fundamental pinnings of the plot of the book only work if you forgot that radar had ever been invented. And it was painful, but even then I feel like that book had fallen down on a couple other levels for it to annoy me so much. Actually, to me, I think the one thing that I'm sometimes frustrated by is when a hard SF thing
in which I don't know, a comet or something strikes the moon and breaks the moon up, and 30 minutes later, fragments of the moon are raining down on San Francisco.
A lot of times I'm totally happy with the hand waving. You know, if you need it to happen for the story to go on, okay, no problem.
But I'm pointing, even with my limited knowledge of science, I'm having a problem here. Like, shouldn't a copy editor or something, this is one of those things where you think that at some point the writer, after the book had come out, would have slapped his forehead and said, oops. But at no point during the process of writing or revising or publishing this book did that, and the novel has no explanation for this at all, other than the fact that apparently the moon is traveling at two or three times the speed of light once it's blown up.
But actually, you know, when I was talking with Karen Lord just a couple weeks ago, we were saying that that sometimes it's the sociology that falling down that that bugs us more, like when people forget that science has to operate in the same climate as where there's media present. That changes how science works. Or
true.
When you're talking about the management of gigantic, you know, engineering projects, that is a unique subculture. And when you just can hand wave all that away and say, oh, and then they built a generation starship, you're like, I think you skipped a bit there.
Mm-hmm.
I think writers, part of what we do, if we're doing it well, is we make the person reading what you're writing forget about the parts we're leaving out. And I used to write advertising, technical advertising, and at one point I wrote a rather lengthy book for Digital Equipment Corporation on the future of computing, on the present and future of computing. Mm. And it was an advertising project rather than a technical writing project because I put a promotional spin on it. I described it in the present and future of computing as if Deck had invented it, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And did it in a way that would convince even IBM that Deck had invented all of it. And I worked with engineers at DEC to do that. And the hardest part was writing the future of computing. And this was 30 plus years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all since come to pass, what I wrote. But at the time, it was a little hard for me to wrap my head around what was going to happen with distributed data processing and the internet and stuff like that. And I had to sit down with the engineer, listen to him, and I took notes like crazy. And then I went back to my office and I wrote like crazy and tried to get it all out and think about it and put the promotional spin on it and everything. And I took it back to him and he read it. You know, it was a few thousand words. It's just a single chapter. And he said, this is great, except for this one little part here. And he pointed out something that he didn't. He said, this part's wrong. And I said, what do you mean? And he started explaining to it. And I realized I'd totally misunderstood everything he was telling me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I said, well, I'm going to have to rewrite the chapter. And he said, no, it's only this little part that's wrong. And I said, no, the whole chapter is wrong.
That's right, yeah.
Trust me on this. And I went back to my office and I rewrote the whole chapter in the light of a new perspective on it. And then he read it again, and he said, yeah, this is fine. But what I realized was that he'd been glossing over stuff that was really written from the wrong point of view, simply because I finessed it. That's my personal skill in writing technical advertising, is I can listen to what somebody says without understanding half of what they're saying and feed it back in a way that makes them think I understood what they said. And I've done this with electrophoresis and, you know, other kinds of technical subjects rather than just data processing.
Goodness, sometimes I feel like that's my whole career in my darker moments.
When I say this to scientists, they all say that, yeah, that's what I do too. And I don't understand that. They actually know what they're talking about, whereas I just model it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have a conversation with Hans Moravec at one point about that very thing. And his point was that everybody models everything.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
But I think it's some that writers model it with less information.
Well, and science fiction writers have to model it with hypothetical information or wildly incomplete information, which is what makes to me, that's always made that's what really makes the difference between science fictional imagination and mimetic imagination, I guess, is that you're dealing with completely inadequate information, some of which is missing, some of which is completely contingent, and some of which you just make up. Whereas a domestic novelist, the realistic novelist, pretty much has the world handed to them. You may not understand characters' motives, you may not understand everything that's going on in it, but But by and large, you know, you're modeling a world that people can immediately recognize.
And that's what makes more popular fiction or even literary fiction more popular, because mm-hmm. it's so easy to get into. You don't have to really... I read an interview of one writer, and I can't remember her name, in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago, and she said that how she was having such a hard time with her novels now because you can't leave cell phones out of a novel, because mm-hmm. they really, you know, cut through space and time in a way that you couldn't do that before. And so, you know, that was something that you just have to take into account now. It's yeah. It's like kind of the slow seepage of thing. It's the way that science fiction is, except it's much more radical, and you kind of have mm-hmm. to take into account your own particular vision of the future that you have to support as a writer. Like Eileen said, you have to take all the details, feed all the mm-hmm. details in that make it seem realistic, and build that world sometimes out of something very, very thin, and make it dense and mm-hmm. real.
I think this is part of what Bruce Sterling talks about when he talks about wallpapering over something. Which is an image I especially enjoy.
Well, it's the old saw about, you know, the only responsibility of the novelist is getting away with it. I think it was Ian Forster or somebody yeah, said that.
Wonderful. Well, I did. It actually turns out we've been talking for about an hour, so this is probably a good place to wrap up and let you guys get back to parties and bars and such like that. Oh.
We are all so unhappy that we're not crowded into a sweaty room of 700 other people with a tiny glass of wine in each hand. Yeah. Well, you're so resentful you made us do this.
Right, right. And where you can't have an extended conversation because you'll get interrupted five times.
Right, exactly.
But let's see. So to the way we usually close Locus podcasts is to ask folks what they've got going on right now, or if there's anything they'd like to promote, or let people know if it's out. Obviously, Kathy, you've got In Shared Dreams.
This Shared Dream.
Sorry, This Shared Dream.
Got a wonderful review by Gary Wolf, Russell Lutzen, and Michael Dearda at the Washington Post, who completely got the novel. It's set in Washington, D.C., so and it's lovingly set there, and that's where he lives, in the Washington D.C. area. So that was a marvelous thing. And I also will have a collection of short stories coming out from PS Publishing called Angels and You Dogs. Good. But I don't have it. It's all turned in and everything. And they're using one of my paintings as the cover. It's just absolutely beautiful. And I don't know when it's coming out, but sometime in the next couple of months. Or
goodness, there are a lot of just awesome short story collections that are going to be coming out over the next year. Eileen?
And I'm working on the Mark Twain story, Whatever Happens to It, and on a YA novel. And I do have a story coming out in Asimov's, probably in the late winter, beginning of next year, that I wrote with Rudy Rucker called The Hive... It's called Hive Mind Man. It's a very Rudy Rucker story.
Well, and speaking of Rudy, we shouldn't neglect to mention that you recently edited an issue of Forb.
That's right, in February. Mm-hmm. And Rudy's got another issue coming out, I think, in September there'll be a new issue. But I'm very pleased with that issue. I had an awful lot of fun doing it, and I think it's extremely cool.
Yeah, it showcases a lot of authors that people likely haven't heard of.
Yeah, I managed to get three authors in Mexico to send me translations of their work. The hard part is getting the work translated, and they already had translations, and they sent me the translations and the original Spanish stories, and they're both up on the site.
Wonderful. And Gary?
Nothing that you don't already know about. I mean, I had a couple of books this year. I keep getting these friends on Twitter that say they have secret project, and they all spell it the way Lucy does in, you know, in Peanuts. And I've got a couple of secret projects which I am not permitted to discuss yet, but they're going to be really exciting by the end of the year. I hope I can talk about them.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you have a great rest of your WorldCon.
Okay,
thank
thanks.
You.
We're working on it.
Good night.